first came across the work of the Romanian Eastern Orthodox theologian Dumitru Staniliu in 1993, when he was relatively unknown in the West. His life is a remarkable story of faithfulness to Jesus under persecution and suffering. He was a married priest and for many years professor of theology at the Theological Institute in Bucharest, but under the communist regime worked under severe restrictions for many years and was imprisoned from 1958 to 1962. However, in 1968 he made the first of several trips to England and was given hospitality by the Anglican Sisters of the Love of God in Oxford. There he gave a lecture called The Victory of the Cross, and this is what I stumbled across in 1993. In 1978, after 60 years of work, he published his three-volume Orthodox Dogmatic Theology, but because of the continuing political isolation of Romania, this remained unavailable in English until after the fall of the communist government in 1989. Since the collapse of the regime, Staniliu has become increasingly known in the West, although he died in 1993, and his major works are slowly being translated. His theology, forged, as it were, in years of isolation and suffering, is alive, creative, fresh, and full of the Spirit. He is perhaps becoming best known for his insights that organically connect the doctrine of creation and the cross, or perhaps I should say collapse the artificial wedge that Western theology has driven between them. The phrase the dialogue of the gift is central to his understanding of creation, and this is what I want to briefly discuss. Staniliu points out that traditionally we've seen creation as saying something about God, his majesty, his artistry, his creativity, and his power. And of course all this is true. The heavens do indeed declare the glory of God. Creation is a theophany, a magnificent manifestation of the beauty and grace of the triune God. However, Staniliu points out that while traditionally we've seen creation as saying something about God, we've often failed to realize that creation is equally saying something about man. And this is summed up in his phrase, the dialogue of the gift. He gives the example of gift-giving that we're all familiar with at birthdays, anniversaries, or Christmas. If, for example, you give your wife a necklace on your 10th wedding anniversary, the gift itself is speaking. It's establishing a dialogue. It's saying, this is how much I value our relationship. This is how much you mean to me. This is how grateful I am that you share your life with me. This is how much I love you. And the necklace says all this silently as she pulls the bow, opens the box, and joyfully handles the silver chain and the diamond pendants. The gift has established a dialogue between you. And this is what gift-giving is all about. Now, if your wife works, she probably could have saved some of her wages and gone out and purchased the necklace for herself and ended up owning the same piece of jewelry. She could have even asked the shop to gift wrap it for her, and she could have formally opened it when she was alone. but it would not speak. It would be a simple artifact, beautiful but mute. No dialogue would take place between her and the necklace because it was not a love gift. Stanilau insists that creation is not only saying something about God, but it's equally saying something about man. It's saying the creation is essentially an extravagant love gift. When I give a necklace to my wife, I'm saying something about how much she is worth, and in particular, how much she is worth to me, how much she is loved by me, and how much the relationship is valued. This is the meaning of the gift, and this is what the extravagant love gift of creation is saying to every human person. This gift, in all its magnificence, is saying something about how much Adam is worth, and in particular, how much is worth to God, how much is loved by God, and how much the relationship is valued by God. The vast beauty and splendor of creation is the measure of the value of God's love for Adam. This is the dialogue that the gift is meant to silently establish. However, several things need to be said at this point before we move on. The first is that it's not without significance that the word Adam is used in two distinct ways in Scripture. It's both a personal name for an individual and a word for humankind in general. In Genesis 5:2 we read, quote, "He created them male and female and blessed them, and when they were created, he called them Adam." Therefore, when we read of God's dealing with Adam the individual in Genesis 2, there's a very real sense that we're meant to read ourselves into the text, as Adam represents both an individual and humankind in general. And it's of crucial importance to do this, as if a gift is for everyone, then in a sense it's for no one, and it's devalued. I well remember the occasions when our children were growing up, when we made the mistake of buying a family gift at Christmas. It would usually be something utilitarian that was needed by the whole family, perhaps a tent for camping in the summer. Such gifts were never a success simply because they were for everyone. We were a family of six. Then, in a sense, because they were for everyone, they were for no one. Now, had the tent been for one of my sons, they would have been delighted with the gift. But a gift for everyone is a gift for no one, and we soon learned that family Christmas gifts were not a great idea. And this is the importance of grasping the concept of Adam in Scripture. The word is purposely ambiguous, as I'm meant to read myself into the text, and it's crucial to do so if we're to understand the dialogue of the gift when it applies to the gift of creation. While it does not say so in the text, I often speculate as to whether God showed Adam the whole panorama of creation after he'd given him dominion and the mandate to be fruitful and multiply, in a similar way to which Satan showed Jesus, the last Adam, all the kingdoms of the world. Although it's only a theory, it would seem reasonable for two reasons. The first is that if he was to have dominion over the earth, it would seem reasonable to assume that he would need to have some idea of the territories over which his dominion extended. The second is that if he was to appreciate the wonder, the beauty, and the majesty of the gift he had been given, it would seem reasonable that God would have to show it to him. How could he appreciate it without being shown the mountain ranges of the Himalayas, the rainforests of the Amazon, the islands of the Pacific, the glaciers of Alaska, and such marvels as Niagara and Victoria Falls? Granted that the earth's surface would not have been then what it is now, but equal wonders must have existed. And it would seem that he would have to be shown something of the beauty and magnitude of the gift he was given if he was to appreciate what the gift was saying about how much he was loved and valued by the Lord himself. And of course, once he had seen it, once the penny had dropped, his incredulous response would have been to ask, "Is all this really for me?" And once he comes to this point, the dialogue of the gift begins, wide-eyed with the words, "Is all this really for me?" on his lips is when the depths of the love of God can begin to break in on his spirit and imprint him with the revelation of how much is valued in the eyes of God. However, at this point we need to tread carefully, as for some strange reason we find it impossibly difficult to see the magnificent creation in personal terms. As Christians, we see it as a gift to mankind in general, but not as a gift to me personally. We see a nature program on TV about Alaska, and it's absolutely stunning. A pristine paradise of lakes and mountains, and just one of their seven national parks is as big as Switzerland. And while we do indeed see it as proclaiming the glory of God, we find it almost impossible to see it as an extravagant love gift to me. Its vast magnificence proclaiming how much I am worth in the sight of God. But this is indeed what God is silently saying through Alaska. It's meant to initiate the dialogue of the gift in just the same way as when you give your wife a diamond necklace. We get a glimpse of this when someone's given a house or a large piece of land. They're overwhelmed by the gift. They're deeply moved by the love of the person who gave such an extravagant gift. And this is how we're to view creation. You are Adam. No one else is around as far as God is concerned. He wants to present it all as a gift to you, just as he did in the beginning on day six, so you can enter into the dialogue of the gift to the same depth that Adam did. Strangely, we don't have the same problem with the cross that we have with the creation. I know the cross is for all, and yet I seem to be able to personalize the love of God for me in the death of Jesus. I know the death of Jesus is for everyone, and yet that does not stop me from making it intensely personal. His love is so great, it's as if he died for me and me alone. But we have trouble doing the same thing with the gift of creation. The fact that it's for everyone makes it hard for us to make it intensely personal, to appropriate it as an extravagant love gift in the same way as we do with the cross. But until we personalize the gift of creation in the same way as we do with the gift of redemption, we will fail to enter into the dialogue of the gift. Walking in the English countryside was something I did frequently for many years before a spinal injury stopped me from doing so. Often when I'd come across a particularly beautiful forest or a view of the North Downs, I would stop and say to the Lord, "Father, you did all this just for me." And I meant it, seriously meant it. Because if it was not made for me, then who was it made for? Again, if a gift is for everyone, it's for no one. And this is the whole point. We must break through and see the wonder of the gift that we've been given and stop simply admiring creation as if it belonged to someone else. We've become blind and robbed of the priceless gift that's right before our eyes. I also believe that the immense size of the cosmos is meant to teach us that God would gladly give each of us a planet as beautiful as planet Earth, but to do so would not make us happy, as personhood is constituted relationally, and such splendid isolation would not meet our need for relationship and community. But to make the point, he simply calls humankind Adam and expects us to put two and two together. We're meant to conclude that in the mind of God, when we are born, day six of creation takes place all over again. He wants to present creation to us, just as he did to Adam, as a love gift, as if no one else existed, as if it was just for me. Because, as I've said repeatedly, if it's for everyone, it's for no one, and the value of the gift falls to the ground, and the dialogue never begins. We will not understand the meaning of creation fully until the dialogue of the gift takes place in our lives, just as it did in Adam's. We might appreciate intelligent design. We might see creation as declaring the glory of God, a theophany of his presence, and a display of his artistry. But even if we've gone this far, we still have not understood the fullness of creation theology. Creation is indeed saying something about God, but only so he can then say something through it about man, about how much is loved and valued by being given such a priceless gift. And once we enter the dialogue of the gift, we discover more. We discover that this majestic cosmos is not an end in itself, but rather it is the means to achieve a deeper purpose, that the creation of the heavens and the earth are the stage, the platform, the superstructure on which God will work within time and space to bring us into the heart of the Trinitarian family, to adopt us as his sons and daughters forever. This purpose, Paul tells us, precedes creation, but creation became the vehicle within time and space to make such a breathtaking plan possible. But the creation, the stage, the platform, the superstructure on which God was going to work within time and space to bring us into the hearts of the Trinitarian family was itself full of transcendent meaning, and it needed to be, as it was the beginning of the dialogue of love that would communicate to man how uniquely he was loved and valued. And the dialogue of love initiated by creation would eventually be consummated by the dialogue of love in incarnation. And in a beautiful way, Stanileo collapses the distance between them. Both creation and incarnation are a magnificent movement of grace in order that we might be brought into the hearts of the Trinitarian family of love. This is the gospel, and Stanileo has done us a great service by recovering the dimension that we've neglected as evangelicals, the dialogue of the gift, the extravagant gift of creation that speaks of the depth to which we're loved and valued by God, and prepares us for the next great gift, the gift of incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection, so that we can find our home forever in the hearts of the Trinitarian family of love.